This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick CPE is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for May 13th, 2013. We have eight items selected this week. Nine. All right. Starting with final regulations requiring employer identification number holders to provide current information. That's interesting. A ruling that a taxable co-op cannot aggregate patronage and non-patronage income in determining its qualified domestic production deduction. Another ruling out of a field attorney advice that elected constables are employees of a county for tax purposes. IRS ruling on the donation of depreciated property by a corporation with respect to the Section 291 20% haircut. And then a 500-plus page Joint Committee on Taxation report to the Senate Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee on the prospects for tax reform. A case remanded to the tax court because the IRS appeals office failed to give proper consideration to an offer in compromise. A case dismissed in the tax court because the entity appealing had its corporate status revoked and was not a valid corporation at the time it filed its appeal in tax court. A researcher, so-called, a retired university professor who tried to deduct the expenses of living in France for a part of each year because he was doing research. Those deductions were disallowed because the professor did not meet the 9 customary standards for testing such an activity for profit motive. Finally, we have a failure of a ROBS transaction. It was marketed by another name by a CPA out in Colorado, but it's one of those transactions where you're supposed to be able to take the money out of your IRA, buy a business, but because you meet all the technical requirements, you're not really using the IRA for personal purposes, and all the profits of the business wind up in the IRA. Doesn't always work, and it did not work in the matter of Lawrence F. Peek, 140 TC number 12, which we'll talk about at the end of today's program. First, we have final regulations requiring employer identification number holders to provide current information as to the individual who is responsible for the affairs of the enterprise. Prior to 2010, when the IRS changed the Form SS-4 to require the disclosure of the responsible person and the responsible person's Social Security number, many Forms SS-4 were filed by nominees. The IRS is concerned that it does not have proper records since some of the nominees are no longer the proper nominees. And according to the IRS's statement, updating the application information is necessary for effective tax administration. The listing of nominees or others who are no longer associated with an entity might prevent the IRS from gathering and maintaining correct information for the responsible party, and having the information will prevent unnecessary delays by allowing the IRS to contact the correct individuals when resolving a tax matter. So, the IRS will soon publish a form for persons who were issued an employer identification number prior to the 2010 change in the Form SS-4, requiring them to disclose the correct application information to the Internal Revenue Service. Next, a field attorney advisory, 2013-1802F, in which the IRS correctly concludes, by the way, that a taxable cooperative must separately compute its domestic production activities deduction for its patronage and its non-patronage sourced income under subchapter T. It is not permitted to aggregate the two in determining a qualified domestic production deduction. Patronage and non-patronage sourced income are treated separately because of the different tax rules that apply to each. Patronage sourced income is treated as partnership income. The income passes through and is taxed only in the hands of the patrons who receive it through patronage dividends, per unit retains, etc. Non-patronage sourced income is treated like C corporation income, and it's taxed both at the cooperative level and again when distributed as dividends. The Eighth Circuit, to which this decision would be appealed, and I say the decision would be appealed because the field attorney advisory is sent to a field attorney who is involved in the examination of a cooperative that has this issue, has dealt with both a vertical allocation of losses in associated milk producers, which was permitted because that only shifted the losses in time, but kept them solely within the patronage business. In contrast, Farm Service Cooperative, in which the Eighth Circuit ruled in 1980, could not aggregate its patronage and non-patronage income for the reasons previously stated. And yet another field attorney advisory, this one, 20131801F. Elected constables are employees for tax purposes, and the county is the employer. The issues were, are the elected constables serving covered under a Section 218 agreement? Now, a Section 218 agreement, that's Section 218 of the Social Security Act, which was codified at 22 U.S. Code Section 418. And if you're looking for those rules in the Internal Revenue Code, you'll find them in different subsections of Code Section 3121. In any event, are the elected constables covered under Section 218 agreement? Yes or no? Are the constables considered fee-based public officials and therefore subject to self-employment tax? 3. Are the constables employees for the purposes of FICA? 4. Are the constables employees for the purposes of the federal income tax? And 5. If the constables are employees, who is the employer? Well, here's the substance of the field attorney advice. 1. The constables are covered by a Section 218 agreement. They are employees of the county. They are not solely fee-based, as would be required by Section 1402C1, and so they're not fee-based public officials, not subject to the self-employment tax. They are common law employees of the counties that write their paychecks. That means they're subject to both FICA and FUTA and income tax withholding. Next, we have a private letter ruling, 2013-18-003, in which the IRS rules that a corporate taxpayer donating fully depreciated property to charity will not be required to reduce the charitable deduction by 20% of the accumulated depreciation on the property. This is a Section 291 issue, and Code Section 291A1 provides that in a case where a corporation disposes of Section 1250 property, an amount equal to 20% of the excess, if any, of A, the amount that would be treated as ordinary income if such property was Section 1245 property, over B, the amount treated as ordinary income under Section 1250, determined without regard to Section 291A1, shall be treated as gain which is ordinary income. So 291 really requires the corporation to treat 20% of what would be capital gain as ordinary income, but there's an exception. And that exception says that the code section 291A1 will not apply to the disposition of any property to the extent that Section 1250A does not apply to such disposition by reason of Section 1250D. Well, Section 1250D says that the ordinary income rule does not apply when property is disposed of by gift. If you're going to look that up, that's Section 1250D1. Section 1250A does not apply to property which is disposed of by gift. Obviously, a charitable donation is a gift, and the IRS has no problem determining that the corporation will not have to recognize, will not have to reduce the value of its contribution by the 20% Section 291 haircut. May the 6th, the Joint Committee on Taxation released its report, 500 plus pages explaining all of the areas of the current tax law that are under consideration for modification as part of tax reform, and including the reports of various working groups. Indications are that the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, still believes that we should have dollar for dollar debt reduction, and for taxing, if you're going to have a tax increase, you got to have debt reduction. President Obama has said he will not negotiate over the debt ceiling, which is coming up. Everyone else believes it's a wonderful opportunity to negotiate new tax rules. The working groups I mentioned, by the way, cover such areas as financial services, real estate, international taxation, manufacturing, and energy. The working groups apparently have made a contribution to some spirit of bipartisanship, which is going to be necessary if we get any sort of meaningful tax reform. According to one staffer who commented off the record, the working groups got staff and members to know each other in ways that have been difficult in recent years because things are so busy and things are so polarized. In any event, the game's afoot. A lot of information has been made available to the tax writing committees. It is entirely possible that we will get tax reform before the end of 2013. Probable? No. Possible? Yes. Next, we have the matter of Danny Lane, L-A-N-E, TC Memo 2013-121. Here, the IRS, Danny Lane was in the construction business. Obviously, the construction industry went through a real rough patch. He was unable to deposit his payroll tax withholdings for several quarters, and as a result, he owes the IRS significant money. Now, he's now back in compliance. He's filing his returns. He's making his payments. In fact, he has paid all of the tax that would have been due. What he owes is penalty and interest, and he's seeking to compromise that. In evaluating his information, the IRS did not properly calculate the realizable value of his assets. They clearly did not understand the construction business in that the accounts receivable of the general contractor are necessary to pay the subcontractors, and if the subcontractors are not paid, they will file liens on the owner's project. The IRS did not apply the collection standard allowances to determine how much money Danny Lane should be left with. They figured on liquidating all of his equipment to provide part of the settlement. But if they did that, then there would be no income. And Mr. Lane's representative did a really good job of preparing information for the IRS and then pursuing the appeal, in this case, to tax court. The tax court sent it back to the appeals division for further consideration because they did such a bad job of evaluating the taxpayer's offer in compromise. There's a lesson in there someplace, which I think is that we should not count on having IRS personnel evaluate our offers in compromise that are competent to do so. And you may, in fact, have to count on going to tax court to get a hearing by someone who actually understands your issues. Next, in the matter of John C. Hom and Associates, 140 TC number 11, the tax court dismissed an entity's challenge to an IRS notice of deficiency because the corporation's status was suspended at the time it filed its petition, leaving it unable to litigate in tax court. Rule 60C of the Tax Court Rules of Procedure states in part, the capacity of a corporation to engage in such litigation in this court shall be determined by the law under which it was organized. Since the taxpayer's corporate capacity was suspended at the time the petition was filed, in this case June 13, 2011, and was not reinstated until April 2012, shortly before trial, the court has no jurisdiction, or whether the taxpayer has no standing to bring the action in court. Sal Westrich is a retired professor. The citation for his tax court summary opinion is 2013-35. Here are some facts you may find interesting. Dr. Westrich was born in France, became a U.S. citizen in 1953. Since 1959, he has been a professor of modern history at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. In 2000, he was eligible to retire and began receiving retirement benefits from the Pratt Institute and Social Security benefits. He did not, however, completely retire. Instead, switched to teaching half-time so he could devote more time to his research and writing activity. Now, the subject matter of his research was French. Now, mind you, this man was born in France. The subject matter of his research and writing was French. He traveled frequently to France. He initially focused on writing plays. That didn't go well. Then he turned his attention to writing historical studies. That hasn't gone well either. For 2000 through 2008, the taxpayer attached Schedule C to his federal income tax returns, which stated his principal business was research writer. He reported losses each year, never reported any business gross receipts or income. All of the losses related to the taxpayer's trips to France. He characterized the expenses as basically living expenses. Renting a house in France, hiring a typist, a driver, and someone to clean his house. He didn't maintain any books or records of these expenses. He reported losses for 2007 of $59,564 and for 2008 of $37,419. In each case, these were significant reductions of his taxable income. Without those losses, his taxable income would have been $121,000 in 2007 and $94,000 in 2008. The tax court went through the standard nine factors, the manner in which the petitioner carried on the activity, didn't have a business plan, his expertise. Well, he was an expert in history, but when his plan didn't work out, he didn't consult any other experts. The time and effort expended. The taxpayer introduced no evidence of the actual amount of time he spent working on his writing. The expectation that assets used in the activity would appreciate, that was a non-starter. There weren't any assets. The success in similar or dissimilar activities, very, very limited. He picked up a few hundred bucks over his whole career from writing. A history of income or loss, that didn't work out so well. The amount of occasional profits, nothing in the taxpayer's favor there. The financial status, clearly, the taxpayer benefited from the losses. The losses offset 49% of his 2007 income, taxable income, and 40% of his 2008 taxable income. Finally, the court considered elements of personal pleasure or recreation and never really dug into what I would have wanted to dig into, and that was the fact that this old retired history professor probably enjoyed living in France. After all, he was born there, especially if he could deduct the expenses of renting a house, hiring a driver, and someone to clean his house. Finally, Lawrence F. Peak, 140 TC number 12. This is a robs transaction, one in which the victims, otherwise known as the taxpayers, are encouraged to roll over money from their 401k or from other IRAs into a self-directed IRA, then start a corporation funded by the self-directed IRA, either acquire or start a business, and have all of the profits generated in the business accrue to the benefit of the IRA, tax-free. Now, that transaction is widely promoted by the sellers of franchises. It has been discussed. The IRS has published a paper on it explaining that you really have to be careful that you comply with all the provisions of the law. In this case, Lawrence Peak and Daryl Fleck participated in a joint business venture to purchase a fire safety company. They each established IRAs into which they rolled over funds from other retirement accounts. In 2001, they set up a new corporation, and their IRAs each acquired 50% of the shares of the new corporation. The new corporation then purchased the fire safety company, the Target, but they did so in part with loans that were personally guaranteed, and that's where they stubbed their toe. The two individuals engaged in a prohibited transaction when they personally guaranteed loans to a company owned by their IRAs. That personal guarantee was an indirect extension of credit between the disqualified person and the retirement plan. And the tax court held that the loan guarantees made on behalf of the Target company were indirect extensions of credit by Peak and Fleck, who were disqualified persons, and so their IRAs ceased to be qualified IRAs in 2001 when the prohibited transaction took place. So there was no statute of limitations argument as to the 2006 returns when they sold the company at a $2 million gain and tried to sequester that gain and those profits in what had then become Roth IRAs. A very clever scheme promoted by a CPA out in Colorado Springs, Colorado, one Christian Blees, who called his version of the Robs transaction the IACC strategy. In any event, Mr. Blees covered his behind with very clear warnings that Code Section 4975 would apply to any self-dealing. Among other things, the letter said, failure to properly manage the corporation's affairs or to conduct business in any manner other than at arm's length could result in adverse effects to the corporation, your IRA, and to you personally. This might include, but is not limited to, the assessment of additional income taxes, penalties, and interest from various taxing authorities. There's no indication in the record that Fleck or Peak ever informed Mr. Blees that they intended to guarantee loans for the corporation that their IRAs owned, and so they could not argue that they relied on their accountant for advice, and not only were they then subjected to income tax assessment, but to penalties as well. Well, that's a wrap for this week. As always, stay safe.